This is Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Hey, and hope you doing well today, Saturday. Wow, we're into the mid of the month. It's the 8th, and days are getting cooler out here in Northern California. I do want to mention that I'm getting some thoughts together about doing a tour of the Yucatan Peninsula next year. It's going to be April. I don't have the specifics. I'm still working on the specifics. If you want to come down with me, I'm going to take about 20, maybe 25 people with me to, we'll be based in Cancun, but we'll tour some of the very oldest areas of the Yucatan Peninsula. We'll see Chichen Itza, which is considered a Mayan university. We'll go to Ekbalam, which has some of the most unusual relief sculpture buildings I've ever seen, including a number of longheads, I call them, these strange humanoids that many people feel have had their heads bound, but it's turning out that this is a whole group of individuals, a whole race of individuals that actually had these extremely long heads and may have had, we don't know. They may have been a form of intelligence we don't know about. But anyhow, that will be covered. And then we want to go to Coba, which is probably the only place in all of the Yucatan Peninsula, all the way down to Central America, that you can climb one of their pyramids. The pyramids you can climb all through there. And it's a monstrous place. And if you want to join me, it'll be a week. We'll do 7 days. You can send me an email to cliff@earthancients.com. And just let me know if you're interested, and I'll send you more information. We can tour, like I said, together. We can talk. I'll have a couple of elders talk to us that I've worked with about their understanding of the Mayan culture. And it's great fun. April's a good time to be down there. It's not too hot. It's easy to get down there. And best of all, it's very inexpensive. I don't know the prices yet, but just as an example, from San Francisco to Cancun, it's about $400 now. $450 maybe if you take a late flight. But it's inexpensive, and that's something to consider. So check it out. Lots of news this week, as always. We're going to have Vlari Yurov come and speak to us. He's the Russian pyramid expert. He's going to be on the program at the end of the month. And Valerie is a brilliant researcher, and he's best known for his work on the Bosnian pyramid. But he did quite a bit of work and research on the Giza area, the Great Pyramid there. And if you go to the Earth Ancients page, Earth Ancients Facebook, go to the group page, you'll see what he's building at Tomsat, Russia. It's a series of modern pyramids. He believes not only do they have great physical benefit, but he believes that there's a physiological effect by being inside these pyramidal structures that helps with not only intelligence, but brain chemistry. And he is of the belief, and we'll hear from him again at the end of the month, that these pyramidal structures are great benefits for evolving humankind. So you can see that. You can see his modern pyramids are just about done. I think he's going to do a official release in the spring of next year, and you can see what he's doing in terms of design. And he has a full article on the benefits of pyramidal structures on human body. So something to consider, something that's fascinating. And I'm actually looking forward to having him on the program, because he's been at a number of conferences. I've spoken to him, and I haven't had a chance to interview him until now, because he's just very, very busy. So Earth Ancients on the Facebook page. Randall Carlson. Randall has set an article regarding the talk he gave us, a two-part article on the mega floods at Boonville, which is the great flood at the Teton Dam. And this mega flood destroyed Boonville and also some of the other outlining cities. And he shows us that this is a tiny, tiny effect that we can also consider as a mega flood, but may have has similarities to the ancient biblical, so-called biblical floods of the Americas that basically carved out the Cascade River in Oregon and came through Washington State and did a tremendous amount of damage about 10,000 years ago. So that's a really interesting article. It's a two-part article you can see on Facebook, Earth Ancients. And then make sure you go to the group pages because that's really interesting. Okay. Oh, what's this about? Yes, it's a big deal, and I'm very happy to announce, and those horns are introducing this announcement, that we have our official website, earthancients.com, and we just launched it. We launched it after a number of months, delay after delay after delay, and I encourage you to go there, and if you go there, I want you to sign up, and when you sign up, I'm going to be raffling off 5 copies of Magicians of the Gods from Graham Hancock. I've got 5 copies that were sent to me by the publisher. And also, when you sign up, you'll be a part of the newsletter, part of all the information. I have my own articles that you can read on there. My blog is posted on there, including all the past programs. But we're going to be packing this website with tons of material, and get on there fast to get into the program. Once you sign up, you'll be automatically enrolled in a number of raffles, but also have opportunities to get original articles, get original content, and we'll be giving away a lot of stuff too. So www.earthancients.com. Make sure you get on there. It's a fun and active website, and I'm really happy to finally announce it. Boy, it's been months. I think I've announced that we're going to have the website at like 4 different times, and it had to be delayed for one reason or another. So finally got a great webmaster, a great designer, Mark Forster, who's in the UK. And he does William Henry's website and a number of other authors' website, and he's fantastic. So, Mark, thank you very much. Also, I'm going to say hello to and thank you to Curtis, the artist, who's done a lot of work on the program. Fantastic. Thanks, Curtis. The design on this site was really great. So we are bringing back John Anthony West. We had John, and I was looking at the program 2 years ago, April 2014. John was the very first guest on Earth Ancients. And those of you who have followed in from the very beginning, remember we talked a lot about not only his first book, Serpent in the Sky, John and Robert Schock's work on the Sphinx was amazing. And we do know that the movie that he helped produce, Mysteries of the Sphinx, not only was seen by millions of people, and this is, Jesus, must be over 20 years now. I think John won an Emmy. So, John, how you doing today?
I am doing just fine. Thank you, Cliff. I did win an Emmy. That's true.
Yeah. Now, is that prominently displayed for all to see when they walk in the front door of the John Anthony West properties?
Well, it's sort of up on a bookshelf, so hiding among other things. She looks much better on the track record than she does on the shelf, actually. It's a hideous statue. It looks like it was designed by Hitler. But anyway, it's still, yeah. It is an Emmy.
Good. No, that was wonderful. Now, you were just out here in Palm Springs at the CPAC, which is the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. Were you out here to do a talk on a specific subject, or is it just an update? Because I think Robert was there too, right?
Yes, Shock was there as well, and a few other very interesting speakers. And yes, I was out there to talk about some various new developments and wrinkles on certain old things. It was a very interesting conference. It was at, actually not Palm Springs, near there, at Rancho Mirage, which technically shouldn't exist if it's a mirage, but there you go. So I was there for that, and also actually prior to that to do an interview with the irrepressible Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Yeah, that was I caught some of that. That's a three. He goes on for 3 hours, which is
no. Amazing. I go on for 3 hours, and he lets me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you were out in California, so that's interesting to talk about. So we want to talk about a few things. We want to catch up with what you've kind of your continual research on the Great Giza Pyramid area, the Giza Plateau. And I want to start basically with checking in on any updates you can provide us with the Sphinx or any of the other very, very, very old buildings that are in the plateau or in the surrounding areas. Is there anything to talk about, anything to report?
Well,
that is,
there is an Estancia cliff. There's no new, let's say, truly groundbreaking or consequential evidence. But what there is some forward movement on getting ourselves both the funding and the permissions to continue on with the work, because we've been pretty much, in a sense, you might say, stymied for since the last time we gave a presentation at the GSA, that's the Geological Society of America's annual meeting, which was in Reno in 2000. And we have a ton of evidence that we feel is absolutely smoking gun evidence. It is anyhow. I mean, this is a test of the basically of the obduracy of the intellectual Egyptological establishment, and it applies not just to Egyptology. They're not worse anyway, not much worse than establishments in any other field of scholarship. That they will fight to the death before they accept anything that is genuinely new and that makes them change their minds about anything whatsoever other than the tiniest details. So we've been hamstrung for all this time, unable to do further work that would, in fact, nail down the evidence in such a way that they simply couldn't turn their backs on it or refute it, of course. So we were there on a recce with a, I can't talk, I'm actually at a position that I can't really talk that other than in vague terms about it, but we were there on a reconnaissance looking into what we would like to look into or what we would like to further study in great detail given the funding and the permissions to go in there and do it. So the trip didn't go exactly the way we wanted. We didn't get to certain of the places we wanted to get to, but we did establish a connection with the new Minister of Antiquities, who seemed pretty open to us continuing our work as long as all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed in terms of applying for permissions. To that end, Robert Shock, after all of these years battling his own colleagues in the Archaeological Department of Boston University, has been a major change of mind there, because the university itself, the top guns there, whoever make the decisions about what to support intellectually and what not to support, have kept free of this internal conflict, and just recently they've had a big change of mind and are now willing to formally support any major further investigations that we might be doing. And this is absolutely essential, because in order to get the permissions that we need a university behind us the actual university, not just Robert Schock, who is, of course, a tenured professor of geology there. So this is
would you,
a big
would
deal.
Would you say that having the university behind you maybe opens doors because that maybe legitimizes your research? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And simply stated, you can't get permission to do any further work. It's not the 19th century where anybody with a few bucks and a shovel can go in there and start looking around. It's now a seriously bureaucratic enterprise, and you have to be able to fulfill all of the, you know, all of the requirements, which most of which we can now fulfill, except for the funding. And this is what we're still looking into, and without going into a long palaver, there are possibilities, various possibilities open. So we are pretty confident that within not too long, we will be able to actually get back in there and lock down certain pieces of evidence that are critical to convincing are critical to, you know, in one sense, you don't convince the opposition. You have to beat them into the ground. But that are critical to making it obvious to anyone who is not formerly an Egyptologist or archaeologist that the evidence is overwhelming and impossible to refute, and that the overriding significance of the whole enterprise is to establish that we, what I call our Church of Progress, we, which I call actually shiny barbarism, we as the builders of the hydrogen bomb and nerve gas and bobblehead dolls in Disneyland, that we are not the most advanced human beings ever to walk the face of this planet. And this has considerable important psychological and philosophical implications. So we feel that we're getting close to being able to lock down or to present the evidence in such a way that it is no longer possible to ignore it or to refute it.
Now, you travel to the Giza Plateau annually, John. I mean, you do tours there on a regular basis.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
We know that Zahi Hawass has been relieved of his position there, but would you say that there is a thirst for knowledge by the academics that are Egyptian, that are in that area? Or would you say it's I mean, that's basically, without being insulting, that's kind of a third world area in terms of not only ideology religious-wise, but for a number of reasons, it's a tough area. But would you say that that is their ideology, their just general lifestyle makes it tough to do work there because the powers that be have their minds on other things, like the dollar from the tourists, or what?
No, absolutely not. When it comes to scholarly or scientific establishments, all of them are third world. None of them have the slightest interest in studying or in learning anything that genuinely challenges the beliefs they already have. So in Egypt, there's absolutely no. There are absolutely no hindrances to us doing our work. There were, actually, with Zahi, it was what was more difficult. Zahi, by the way, is not out of the picture. And just for the record, personally, believe it or not, we get on pretty well.
Really?
Doctrinally, yeah, on a personal level. It's a long story, and we only have an hour here, but it's a long story of how we buried the hatchet. Very interesting story, but that we can't tell it here. This goes on too long. But anyway, Zahi is in a position sort of, it's not official, but he's sort of the goodwill ambassador, and he's very patriotic, Zahi. So his interests are really in basically trying to make it clear to an awful lot of people who are afraid to go to Egypt that it's safe to go there, and it certainly is. I mean, it's certainly a lot safer than anything here. It's weird that Americans should be afraid to go to Egypt when you look at the reports here. There's no day that goes by that there's some nutcase who isn't shooting up a school or a post office or some other kind of, you know, or the police gunning down some poor unarmed black guy. Any American who's afraid of going to Egypt has to rethink his or her position, because it's certainly a lot safer than it is here. It doesn't mean that something can't happen. Just as you get in your car every morning, do you think that, hey, today maybe is the day I get in a wreck and die? No, you don't think that way, even though on that day somebody in your county is probably going to get in a wreck and die. So these kinds of irrational fears are always, they're always in the air, and they're very hard to combat. Anyway, that said, sorry, I'm going off track.
No, that's fine.
We're okay there, and in fact, the new Minister of Antiquities, who replaces Zahi, actually there was a guy there before him and a guy there before him, but he's a bureaucrat, but a very intelligent bureaucrat, and we got the sense that as long as I said before, the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, that we'd get permission to continue. And then we also met up with the director of the new giant museum that they're building, should be ready in about a year, maybe a year anyway, too. It's about the size of Rhode Island. It's going to be an absolutely amazing place with all sorts of scientific laboratories attached to it. And he was genuinely interested in looking into anything that is new and has evidence behind it. So we're feeling as though it may not be too long before we break down the portcullis that safeguards the ivory tower in which the quackademics, I get a lot of flack for calling them quackademics, but I also get a lot of people who think, what a great word, that where the quackademics think that they're still safe. So we shall see. But there's a thing, actually, I talked about this at length, I think, on Joe's show, and a little bit more politely at the CPAC conference, so I'll just bring it up here, that everybody knows, probably everyone listening knows the famous line from Victor Hugo, the great French 19th century poet and playwright, Victor Hugo, there's one thing stronger than all the armies in the world, and that is an idea whose time has come. What Hugo didn't think of, upon which I elaborate at some length, is that the second strongest thing in the world is an idea whose time has not yet gone. And since all the armies in the world, be they scientific or scholarly or agricultural or economic or financial or even artistic and cultural, all those armies are formally or de facto in the service of the idea whose time has not yet gone. So, on the new age level, anybody who thinks that just because the evidence is good enough, that sooner or later, that idea or that this whatever the evidence pertains to, is going to take hold and take over, is living in an illusion. It might not. It's a battle, and it is a war. And as in any war, all's fair. So this is what we have been up against, actually, for over 30 years. The evidence is there in any other discipline in the world. Well, maybe not even, but there's always this battle that really should have been established long ago. But we think we're close to, or we're on the verge of breaking through and establishing this once and for all, which could have, only could, it's not necessarily that it will have, but it could have very important implications for, on a day-to-day level, on how people regard their own individual and, by extension, collective role play within the cosmic scheme, which now, of course, in Church of Progress terms, there is no such thing as a grand cosmic scheme. Everything is an accident. Everything is coincidental, and we make no difference whatsoever if we're good guys or bad guys or brilliant or not so brilliant or criminals. Mm-hmm. It's really all the same. We live, we die, and that's the end of it.
Right. And, I want to touch base on, with you on what you feel is ancient Egyptian philosophy kind of focus that also Schwaller de Lubitsch talked about in his book that you so beautifully interpreted in your first book, The High Wisdom of or Serpent in the Sky. But before I do that, I just want to touch base with you a little bit on the actual Sphinx. We've had a couple of different research investigators show some photographs of different times when the Great Sphinx was being excavated and actually repaired. And there's some curious photographs I wanted to ask you about, and you may not know anything about these, but there's a couple of pictures of Zahi Hawass appearing in front of the Sphinx paws, appearing out of some kind of a tunnel. And then there's another picture of him standing on the back of the pyramid coming out of of the Sphinx coming out of another, looks like a hole, a port in the back of the body. And it appears that there's some highly controversial photographs of what appears to be a canal, a water canal that runs apparently underneath the Sphinx and goes all the way up to the Great Pyramid. Now, people like Christopher Dunn have speculated that the Sphinx, and not just Chris Dunn, there's other people, have speculated that the Sphinx may have been part of some apparatus, a pump apparatus that brought water into the Great Pyramid and was part of a network of underground tunnels that appear to be quite prominently displayed underneath the Giza Plateau. We don't know if it goes beyond the Giza Plateau, but let's focus on the Sphinx right now. Are you aware of any of this information of some kind of an underground water?
I'm aware of it, but I wouldn't call it information. I would call it at the most polite speculation. I don't think Chris mm-hmm. is for 2 seconds talks about the water pump idea stems from a guy called Kunkel, Edward Kunkel, back in the 1920s, where he postulated that it was part of a, not the Sphinx itself, but the pyramid actually was a gigantic ram pump. And strangely enough, when you look at the interior chambers, they are sort of similar, but it's mm-hmm. next to impossible. And without going into a long palaver, it's absolutely impossible to imagine how they'd get the water up to the pyramid and then where is it going to pump it to and to what end. The so-called canals and channels and stuff like that that run from the Sphinx to the pyramids do not show up on anybody's seismographs, and the seismograph doesn't channel. This is New Age unicorn speculation, as far as I'm concerned. That mm-hmm. the pyramids are not tombs; that the pyramids serve a function. I mean, Chris is absolutely right in that regard, and I mean his work is very careful of these things that. Things that are, tolerances of a 1/10,000th of an inch. How do they accomplish that without some sort of technology? But the technology, initially, he was thinking that, it had to be our kind of technology. And I never accepted that. Chris has been on a couple of trips with me, so, we know each other pretty well. And I think he's now changed his mind to the extent that he still thinks it's a device of some sort, and so do I. But, mm-hmm. Not to generate energy in our sense, to generate some kind of energy in the service mm-hmm. of a philosophy that underpins everything in Egypt, which is the philosophy of the potential immortality of the soul, which has to be understood in a not physical sense. I got in some trouble on Rogan's show with a bunch of jackasses commenting about, ha, 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 John West, this nutcase, believes in immortality. Well, so I do, but not in the mm-hmm. sense that we live on forever in a much more, sophisticated, esoteric sense. In other words, if I can use that word and make sense mm-hmm. of it, it's a a capacity that human beings have, and everybody has always believed this, up to our idiot's Church of Progress, that we are capable of arriving at higher levels of consciousness where the body dies, yes, but it leaves behind a, for lack of a better word, an illuminated spirit that is not subject to physical death. And all of Egypt, Egypt is a one-issue civilization in that sense. Everything but everything that, that remains of Egypt is consecrated or dedicated to furthering that quest, all of it, without any exceptions whatsoever. Since the objective of the quest is immaterial, in other words, it's not physical, it's impossible to prove in physical terms. To me, what the proof is what they left behind for us to experience. I mean, they didn't design it just for us so that we could go there as tourists in the 21st century and marvel at what they did. They did it for themselves. And the purpose of sacred art and sacred architecture is to connect us to those higher levels of consciousness, higher levels of existence, to which we can aspire, but that which we do not get to automatically as a general rule, but there are exceptions now, because some of us, some people now do get to it. This is what we talked about earlier, that I talk about in the book that I edited for my late friend David Solomon about the near-death experience.
Right. I want to get a little esoteric now, because you interpreted Schwalor de Lubitsch's book. I guess his book's called The Temple of Man, right?
Correct.
And this book is basically a look at what I can only say is the consciousness of what he interpreted the ancient Egypts were all about, their level of consciousness as it appears in the buildings that are left to us. And what I want to ask you is, do you believe that these ancient humans that built these places had a perspective on Earth, on the cosmos, on unseen things like after death, the levels of the dimensions of consciousness and things like that we just don't understand?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that the proof is there.
Okay.
The Bible says somewhere, Matthew, I think, by their fruits you shall know them. And that's their fruits. You have to realize that we are an absolutely, apart from our shiny technology, we are philosophically and spiritually depraved, if not worse than that. So we're not in a position to easily recognize the achievements of the ancients and what they represented. And when I do my trips, by the way, the next trip is in just a few days, and there'll be another one in February. Anybody interested, you can go to my website and get information about that. I often start a lecture by saying that Egypt is like sex, and that of course gets everybody's attention, the magic three-letter word.
But
I mean it not just figuratively. I mean it literally, in the sense that you can read all about it, and that's informative, and you can look at pictures, which is informative in a different sort of way, but you do not and you cannot understand it unless you've experienced it for yourself. You just can't. It's like anything. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about baseball until you've at least tried to play it. Anyway, the point here is that in Egypt, there's so much of Egypt left. You see, probably all the ancient civilizations shared with Egypt the same spiritual, esoteric philosophy, but they, for a variety of reasons, there isn't that much left of it that you can actually experience it for yourselves. I mean, you can't go away to China and experience one temple after another built 2,000, 3,000 B.C., nor can you with any of the other ancient civilizations that we know about. We just can't experience them. But with Egypt, at the end of a couple of weeks there, you really do understand the difference between what actually was once civilization and what we now call progress, which, as I said earlier, I call shiny barbarism. So in answer to your question, yes, I categorically believe that they knew exactly what they were talking about, and it's we who are too stupid or too, let's say, too emotionally defective to recognize the greatness of their achievement. But one way that you can recognize it actually is when you go there and you get hit by the extraordinary emotional power that these structures, that sacred art, this is what sacred art is supposed to do. It's supposed to connect us from whatever our current state of consciousness is, to the higher levels of consciousness that the geniuses that put these things together had access to and could incorporate in these amazing buildings.
Would you say that the term sacred geometry is in play with the dynastic buildings? I mean, and we don't know a lot. We don't have a way to measure energy from buildings. We can measure certain properties, electromagnetic fields coming out of the earth and things like that. But the Maya talk about living, everything is alive, right? And
right,
the elders
right.
who I've spoken to say that the buildings that were created, the pyramid complexes throughout Mexico, are alive. Would you say the same thing about the Egyptian buildings, that they're living, functioning consciousness, or is it something else?
No, absolutely. I would completely agree with that. Goethe, the German poet, once called architecture frozen music. That's not just poetically and metaphorically true. It's literally true. The harmonies and frequencies and so on generated by the sacred geometry is that which we respond to, so that our machines aren't good enough to measure the energy, but we are. We have very sensitive, at least some of us, if we're not Egyptologists or archaeologists, have still functioning, let's say, mechanisms within our own bodies that are capable of receiving these, for lack of a better word, call them vibrations, or stone. We're capable of reacting to the stone music. And each of the temples, when the gods, so-called gods, get a bad rap by the quackademics, they're supposed to be just figments of primitive imagination, looking to explain the mysterious universe that they don't understand, but that we do. And the gods are actually, once it's understood that they're cosmic principles, and so there are principles, let's say the organic principles are fertilization, gestation, birth, growth, maturity, senescence, death, and renewal. Those are principles. They're not just accidents of evolution, as the quackademics would have us believe. And each of those principles is associated with certain, or is embodied in certain of the gods and goddesses. Those gods and goddesses are associated, for a very good reason, but it's complicated, to particular numbers and number combinations, which in turn gestate in and of themselves, by themselves, particular ratios and geometries. And when those geometries are incorporated into a building or a work of art or a particular sculpture, that manifestation registers with our, let's say, our internal faculties for receiving those kinds of vibrations. I mean, for example, science is valueless. It's without value. It can't measure a value. It doesn't know what a value is. In fact, if push came to shove, they'd have to admit that values, or by their standards, values don't exist, because they can't measure them and they can't predict from them, and and they can't, what is the other thing they're supposed to do? They can't replicate them. In other words, science cannot tell us that, or cannot prove to us that Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is a better piece of music than Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. But if you don't know that, deep in your gut, God help you, because no one else can. So with Egypt, when we go there, and as I said, you can get some of it from pictures, you can get some of it from our 8-DVD Magical Egypt, A Symbolist Tour, the DVD series, which is about as close as you can get to the to esoteric Egypt as anything short of going there. So we get that. It registers. And for some of us whose emotional faculties are still functioning, it's unmistakable. You can't miss that it's there. And the reason that it's there is that it's understood that there are higher levels of consciousness that are that we don't have. In principle, we have access to. It takes inner work to get there. It doesn't just happen, except now because of the near-death experiences that I write about, or the book that I edited recently. Mm-hmm. It's now clear that people do access these, or can access these higher levels without necessarily having to be a great master yogi or lama or saint. Prior to this time, apart from a few historical, let's say, exceptions, all of these stories of higher levels of consciousness were associated with the various saints and spiritual masters and yogis and rishis and rishis and so on. But that didn't amount to anything that you could use even as quasi-scientific evidence. But now the plethora of near-death experiences, these experiences are effectively, drugs can do it too, actually, but in a somewhat different way. These experiences are windows into, or doorways through which the people who experience them get to these higher levels of experience. And when it's cumulative, when it's not just one or two or three or six, there are a few thousand of those out there. And, of course, in Quackademia, they protect themselves by refusing to acknowledge that personal experiences are, that personal experiences can be used as evidence for something that science doesn't already believe. But nobody is obliged to take the word of scientists or to believe that they have the God-given right to set the rules. And like buy a cookbook by somebody who's never fried an egg. So these people take it upon themselves to try to maintain that all of these rather interlocked experiences are nothing but sort of aberrations, hallucinations of the dying brain, as if they know what hallucinations. They can't even define what a hallucination is, other than that it's something that they don't believe in. Anyway, so yes, and this is one of the reasons why I feel that we may be, between us all, those of us who are working in this field, I mean, there are a lot of off-the-wall people that or that I believe to be off the wall that I won't get into here, but one of the reasons that I believe we're closing in on, let's say, we're closing in on the idea whose time, the coming of the idea whose time has come. I think we're not far off that point. Still doesn't mean that it's going to happen, but the material is all there, and with a break one way or a few breaks one way or another, it could be that we finally do break through the portcullis and get into the ivory tower ourselves and demonstrate the ancient esoteric conviction that we individually and collectively are here for a purpose, and that purpose is the quest, the successful quest for spiritual immortality, not physical, spiritual.
Okay.
Immortality.
I want to ask you another question about these buildings that you tour in constantly, and then we're going to talk about the NDEs that are featured in this new book that you worked on. I think, well, it's obvious that these dynastic beings, these Egyptians, and also perhaps deep into the pre-dynastic period, had a science that we just do not understand. And the science is, for lack of a better word, because there's no language that describes it, it's an earth-based science, connecting earth energies with the heavens and so on and so forth. We just don't understand it. So all we can do is interpret it based on our current knowledge, our current science, which is horribly lacking. But from what I understand in my research on the Maya had buildings that were designed for fertility, for human harmony, and somehow the stones, either through the carvings or through some energy, were imbued with these subtle energies of these topics, fertility, harmony. There's even some question about great healing that took place in certain chambers. Would you say that the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians who built these buildings, had some science that we're beginning to understand, or will we just never understand it because it's so advanced of anything we can even conceive of?
Well, I'd say that we already understand it to a certain extent. It's just that we can't reproduce it. We don't know it well enough to. We couldn't, for example, without just copying an Egyptian model, design a temple that consecrated to fertility that really worked, or consecrated to some form spiritual exaltation. That they did it, this is known, and it's quite possible to measure it all and see how they did it. In other words, to see what makes, to try and figure out what makes an Amon temple and a Hathor temple, and so on. And when we go into them, we really experience in a very visceral sense the difference between these places. So following Shmuel de Lubitsch, who in my opinion has produced the possibly the most important single work of scholarship since ancient Rome, we understand it. We understand it reasonably well, and it's not that inconceivable to build upon it. And from there, it's just a step, but maybe a giant step, to putting it back into play. For example, I think it's quite possible now to build a sacred structure that we walk into and we know it's not Walmart, that has the kind of effect that an ancient temple or a Gothic cathedral has. This is not inconceivable. It's just that it takes time and money and relatively enlightened beings, and that's exactly what the money is all there, but not available to us, at least not at the moment. And the time and the expertise is there. I mean, given a good budget, I'm pretty sure I personally could put together enough people to build sacred structures and put together a sacred landscape even.
Okay.
It's there. We're closing in on it.
But I mean, we most of us know about the ancient Chinese feng shui technique, where you
right.
have an interior set in such a way that it reflects energy and provides influences and enhancements and things like that. But it seems like these megalithic structures that we see in Egypt have a whole different dynamic that isn't discussed. That you understand on an esoteric level, but I mean, how do we imbue a building with consciousness? How do we pour a concrete foundation that has, You know, I mean, there's some pretty basic things about building that we do, but that they did something that's entirely different.
Yeah, well, but it doesn't, the building itself is not conscious any more than a Beethoven or a Bach, a Beethoven symphony or a Bach cantata is consciousness, mm-hmm. is conscious. It is a consequence of consciousness, and it evokes consciousness at a higher level within the beholder, or in the case of a temple, within the visitor. You go in these places, and particularly when it's the right conditions and it's not a bunch of other people there, and you have enough time to absorb it without people, you know, shouting and guides all over the place talking about it, et cetera, et cetera. And it registers. I mean, I know it from my trips at the end of, and I've done about 100 of them now, at the end of a couple of weeks there, everybody understands that they have experienced something that is not experienceable, at least in human terms, anywhere else. I mean, you can get this from nature. You can get it just by sitting and meditating sometimes. But all of the sacred art and architecture is designed to evoke this within the beholder, to connect us here on Earth to our higher self, which is, I mean, it's connected to us, but it's not normally accessible. And it's not inconceivable that, in fact, the texts even talk about the Hermetica has a extraordinary, I always read this at the end of my trip, extraordinary prophecy about the whole thing coming unstuck, which makes, I mean, sort of, you watch what's going on with the current election, it looks pretty hopeless. But yeah. After all of this has befallen, let's say the cosmic powers come to the aid of the planet and reestablish conditions in which civilization can again flourish. And I absolutely believe that it's a possibility. Not that it's just going to happen automatically, which is a very new agey way to consider it.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I do want to take a moment to remind our audience that this program is sponsored by Gaia. And Gaia is featuring a new program this month. It's a special introductory program that you can enjoy a number of great programs by authors who are featured on our show. They have a lot of ancient science. There's a whole series on Egypt. And to get this information, you go to gaia.com/earthancients.com. That's gaia.com/earthancients.com. For 99 cents, the first month is 99 cents. And you can jump in there. And there's a pyramid series put out by David Wilcox that's very fascinating. And there's hundreds and hundreds of other programs that I would like you to consider. And they support us, and we need that support to continue building this program. So check it out, gaia.com/earthancients. John, I want to talk about this new book, The Dead Saints Chronicles. It's a fascinating book. I mentioned to you before the show that I had Dr. Raymond Moody on the program, who is one of the foremost authorities on that experience he had with thousands of people. But it appears that, and I just touched upon this, and you can tell us a little bit about it. David Solomon, the author, apparently studied the near-death experiences of over 5,000 people. And tell us a little bit about this book. It's fascinating.
Yes. Well, David was a good friend. He died, actually, just after the book was finished. And, in fact, he was collecting all of this material. He was a pastor. He had a very alternative kind of Christian pastor, but a real Christian, you know, in other words, one who was actually doing the work as opposed to talking about what to do, stopping women from controlling their own bodies and all of the other idiocy that a lot of so-called Christians spend their lives or devote their lives to. David was the real article. And he was collecting material on NDEs and systematizing it. He was a very good researcher and very meticulous. And at a certain point, as I said, I knew him quite well, and he came on a couple of trips with us. In fact, financed our trip, Jacques and myself, to Göbekli Tepe a few years back. That, as you probably have dealt with on your show, is the one of the smoking guns proving the existence of a sophisticated high civilization back, in this case with Göbekli Tepe, at least 10,000 years, 10,000 BC, 12,000 years ago. Anyway, David was collecting all of this material, and I said, David, you know, this is a really interesting book, because nothing like this, and I'm fairly familiar with NDE books and NDE experiences. I know I met Moody, but I'm certainly familiar with his work. Anyhow, I said, you know, you're going at it in a way that is a far more scholarly, both scholarly and sympathetic way, something that no one's ever done before. And he said, oh, well, you know, I'm not a writer, and I'm just collecting this for my own interest. And then he started losing his balance, and he was an interesting guy. The book is called The Dead Saints Chronicles, A Zen Journey Through the Christian Afterlife, because he was a Christian pastor, but he had a lot of experience with Zen. He was a bonsai master, and he was a fairly advanced practitioner of Tai Chi. And he was losing his balance, and he was a high-level Tai Chi practitioner. Balance is integral to, is highly developed and integral to the practice. And finally, it got worse and worse. He had to go to the, you know, he went to the doctors. They didn't know what it was initially, and then it was diagnosed as a brain cancer called the glioblastoma. Something pro forma, something, I forget the second name, but this is a completely 100% fatal brain cancer, but it functions in a very peculiar way. It's not excruciatingly painful, and you're given, it's a short lifespan. I mean, David was at a stage 4, and they were giving him 12 to 14 months to survive. He actually ended up with just short of 3 years. But now we realize that he had a mission, which was to turn all of the scholarship that he'd done into an actual book. But what he wasn't, he was an excellent researcher, and in fact very good at titles. It's a great title, The Dead Saints Chronicles, A Zen Journey Through the Christian Afterlife. But what he wasn't was a writer, and of course that's what I am, basically. I'm a writer first and a scholar by default, so he drafted me in to help with it, and he lasted just long enough, died in April, just long enough to get the book out. And,
okay.
So that's what it is, but it's one of those books, and you know, with the idea whose time has come, it's never when they put the first Mercedes out, which is, I think, 1892, you would never have known that automobiles would take over the world. It took Henry Ford to make it possible to get an automobile into the hands of others than the super rich. Well, it's a little bit like that with almost any idea. In this case, the idea that we are, in principle, immortal has been around, well, forever. I mean, it corroborates one of the most interesting things for me about the near-death experiences is that they corroborate the stories, they corroborate the ancient texts, the ancient funerary texts, which are all about immortality and rebirth and reincarnation as well. And it lends, let's say, a personal, living, experiential evidence to the reality of those ancient texts. And so this was my personal point of view, but that idea whose time has come, in other words, you would never have known from the 1892 Mercedes that the automobile would take over the world. Well, so would the NDE. It was first popularized by Raymond Moody. That's in the 1970s. Now, right. What, 40-some-odd years have gone by. There have been a number of books about NDEs, but it still hasn't reached the mainstream. In other words, just recently there are a few books, one by a doctor who experienced an NDE, and CNN, or what was it, HuffPost, did a pretty fair article on it, except at the end where they said, and of course there are others who think that it's just a hallucination. So
right.
A bit of shot of cheap journalism, having laid out the case reasonably well, given that it's the mainstream media, and then at the end contradicting themselves by saying, oh, well, but there are other experts who think it's just a hallucination, leaving the reader with the conclusion, unless they were reading very, very carefully indeed, that, oh, well, it's just a hallucination. So this
Let's talk about this book specifically. And I find it fascinating that it fell into your lap for the simple reason that you must have seen parallels to the dynastic Egyptians' afterlife theme, which they made an industry out of, basically. I mean, so much of their appears to be, I don't know if you can call it religion or part of their industry, was preparing for this afterlife. And maybe they did have a knowledge of afterlife that we don't understand, but it appears that they did, simply because some of the texts reveal afterlife functionalities and things like that. So I see parallels in you being an editor, so it must have been quite comfortable for you to fall into it and flow with it. But what is it in the book that is solid material for us to consider?
Well, it's structured in a way. It's put together the various aspects. I mean, what David has done is he's broken down these remarkable experiences and categorized and systematized them so that they're not just a wash of uncoordinated or unconnected experiences. There's a hierarchy to them and a way to understand them through our, let's say, our usual rational minds, or let's say over-intellectualized minds, in a visceral way that communicates and also that explores the significance of it. See, this is something that most of the other books don't do. Moody, if I recollect, it's long since I've read Moody, does to a certain extent, but even he is kind of wishy-washy about the religious and spiritual aspects of it. I don't think that's necessarily his. It's not a question of it being his fault. It's not his particular focus. With me, it just happens to work out that way. That is
right.
My particular focus. And so, and because I'm a writer, I could apply, let's say, the correct words to it, so that the whole thing, it's not exactly an encyclopedia of the near-death experience as, let's say, a graduate course in making this experience available to people who otherwise might read it and say, oh, well, that's really very interesting, but how do I connect that to my life, or what does it mean to me personally? It's very hard to explain in so many words, but it's exactly that connection that it makes through David's own research and also his own spiritual convictions, his own spiritual practices. He knows what he's talking about and can put it, anyway, I can help him put it into the words to make it communicable. And as with the idea whose time has come, there comes a point when you hammer and hammer and hammer and hammer and hammer, there are all these books out, and then along comes some book or some event or something that precipitates the change. And then the change happens in a hurry. I mean, as an example, and I don't even know how true this is, but supposedly Uncle Tom's Cabin was pretty instrumental in producing the Emancipation Proclamation to get rid of slavery once and for all. It's not as though she invented an anti-abolitionist stance. There have been people talking about that for 200 years. But but when the time was right, and had you written the book 20 years earlier, it wouldn't have had that effect. When the time was right, and she certainly wasn't thinking that it was a book that was about that. She was writing, and she was just writing a book out of a passion for the evil of slavery. And as it happened, the book came out at just the right time. And as I said, you can't really pinpoint or measure her contribution, but it was certainly more than coincidence that it precipitated the change. And my feeling is with David, and always was from the first time he came to me with all of this research, that it was that kind of a book. Doesn't mean that it's going to happen. It has to go a lot more viral than it has up to now, but that it could be one of those books that is instrumental. And one of the reasons for that is that it is absolutely accessible to anyone. Symbolist Egypt, Shwala de Lubitsch, is not accessible to everyone. This is for sure. My own training is in the Gurdjieff work. That is absolutely not accessible to everyone. Even the hard-nosed geology and the archaeoastronomy that is now being developed, that demonstrates the existence of the lost civilization way prior to Egypt, the archaeoastronomy that proves that sophisticated astronomy, it's a hard science, and sophisticated cosmology existed back in those ancient days, that's not available to everyone either. I mean, it's a lot more available than Symbolist Egypt. But the near-death experience phenomenon is something that everyone can resonate to. You can't miss it. And, I mean, nobody's, beating you up to make sure, to ensure that the individual accept it. I don't know. You can take it or leave it. I don't give a damn. But that the potential is there for everyone to recognize that they've been handed a whole bunch of rubbish by what is laughingly called education. If I may quote myself, modern education is to the mind what AIDS is to the immune system. The more exposure you have to it, the more likely it is to be lethal. So we've basically, particularly in the Western world, been brought up to believe a whole bunch of garbage, and the NDE, the Dead Saints Chronicles, of the experiences of these people, could be the game changer. Could be what convinces a lot of people that they've been infected by a whole lot of intellectual and emotional rubbish, and okay, that they can in fact extricate themselves from that. Call it a death warrant.
Well, let me ask you this. So this is, for those of you listening who are not familiar with the near-death experience, what we have, and John, you can correct me after I just kind of give an overview of what this is. When people pass away, when they have been determined to be clinically dead, a near-death experience is obviously somebody who's come back from this experience of being dead. What happens typically is that they enter into a different state. They're dead. They pass on through a tunnel, sometimes through clouds, through whatever. They're met on some level with relatives or people that they remember in physical life. In some cases, they do a review of their past life, what they've done in this life, good or bad. They're seeing a review. And then they pass into higher levels and maybe meet unseen bodies. Could be, some people consider them Christ. If you're a religious person, could be the ancient sage masters of Earth, or it could be just an entity that's considered a higher being. That's about as far as we go, we think. And this is just my memory of this experience, the near-death experience. We think that they are passed into another level, and maybe they rest there for a while, and then they prepare for either another incarnation on Earth or they go to another dimension. So, John, I want to ask you, what does this book provide? Does it provide that evidence, or does it get into specific stories of these individuals who came back and their experiences?
Both actually. That was a good rundown on what the near-death experience is for those who don't have any knowledge of the phenomenon, and mm-hmm. and effectively what people are experiencing is what the great saints and religious masters of all time talk about after a lifetime of, you know, of practice, generally speaking, a lifetime of very hard inner work they get to and can record as best they can, because language doesn't lend itself very well to experiencing these, or to our language is terrestrial, as it were, and experience a few moments or a few minutes in the higher, in the celestial realm, is our words are not really good enough to capture it. But when you have enough people talking about the same, more or less the same experience, and doing the best that they can, and these are not great saints or great poets or great yogis or anything of the sort, they're, for the most part, just ordinary people who have, in one way or another, either a sickness or an accident or strange things, something or another that in which they're dead. They're clinically dead for X amount of time, and there are plenty of evidence to say that they're really dead. And then one thing you left out, in fact, was that many of them talk about not wanting to come back, because where they are is, in Christian terms, it's a state of grace. It's nirvana. It's, with the other words, samadhi in Eastern philosophies. And they don't want to come back, but there are beings, there are higher beings up there who, when that occurs, tell them, no, you've got work to do back here, you've got to come back. And so they do come back, and this is why David calls them the dead saints, because they've recorded the experiences that normally reserved just for those handful of saints and great masters that have bequeathed their esoteric wisdom to us over the centuries. And here there are thousands of these experiences, and the reason why there are thousands is, strangely enough, largely a consequence. It's one of the few good things you could say about our Church of Progress. Our medicine is now so advanced, particularly crisis medicine, that ordinarily these people would have just died. But now, with all of the different techniques that are available to doctors, specifically mostly Western doctors, most of these experiences take place in the West, because it's here that we have the most advanced medicine. So they have the experience, and whereas, let's say, probably 99 times out of 100, they would have just died, because there would have been nothing to resuscitate them. They get resuscitated, and they come back with these extraordinary stories, one after the other, and it's the accumulation of the evidence that is so consequential. Most of the other books up to now have been personal experiences that are very, very interesting, but unless you read a lot of them, they don't register when suddenly there are so many people registering these experiences. And David there is a very, let's say, a very astute and minister, I mean, in the best sense of the word, that's what he was, a minister, but able to put all of these experiences together into a kind of, what do you call, a hierarchy of, you know, at different levels of experience. And by the time you're done with the book, it's, if you're not convinced that we really are here as human beings, that we are really are here for a purpose, well, you're tough luck. That's all I can say. It doesn't bother me one way or the other what people's reactions to this are, but I do know already, even from the reactions to this book, that it has that ability to clarify in a particular way the deep philosophical spiritual question of what we as human beings are here on Earth for, which is not just to behave as sort of slightly more intelligent gorillas. In fact, most of us are not even qualify that way. Anyway, that's, you know, as best I can wing it. Let's say, you know, if I'm writing an essay on it or something like that.
But that's a nice big sweeping overview. Can you give us what you would consider a good example of someone's experience that you thought was outstanding, given your background in understanding esoteric Egypt?
You know, I can't.
Okay.
It's a good question, actually, but I can't wing it. In other words, I have in my head a whole bunch of these experiences, and if you put me to the test, had you said in the first place when we were talking about me being on the show, hey, can you give us some examples that have gone through and picked out a few? But I can't.
Okay. How about this question? Have you, in editing this book, did you come across anything that takes us further? Is there any examples of somebody who goes beyond what we know about the experience of passing through the tunnel, seeing the known relatives, having the assessment of life, and so on and so forth?
Well,
was there one area that maybe was like something like, wait a minute, that's a whole new level that we haven't found?
Yeah, Cliff, I mean, it's that once it's recognized that what they're experiencing, I mean, this is the relatives and all of this, that's sort of the background drama, but the central issue is that it's the issue that words, our words, you know, our terrestrial language does not easily incorporate, but that these people are in what in all of the ancient esoteric traditions is, put it in Christian terms because that's the most familiar here, is a state of grace. It is a few moments, it is a connection with the Godhead, which is what is responsible for us all, despite what the stupid Darwinians are talking about. And this is, in my view, this is maybe the most important question facing humanity today, which is the recognition of its own true spiritual destiny, which is exactly the opposite of what we're taught in our stupid schools.
Okay, that's fascinating.
Anyway.
Yeah. So this book is out now. I did see it. It's on Amazon. It's probably been out a couple of months, hasn't it?
It's been out since April.
Okay.
And, there are a couple of good reviews on Amazon. Anybody who wants individually, you know, they can get it from me personally if they want, in which case I autograph it. David is no longer here to do that himself, unfortunately, but it's not funny, but as we were working on the book and he was, you know, slowly deteriorating, he was a quite incredible role model. I mean, working unbelievably long work days and completely secure in the conviction that that the experience was his. In other words, that he was going, that death was, in fact, as he's put it, that death is ultimately understood esoterically. Death is a lie. The body dies. The spirit lives on in one form or another, and in the form in developed people. It's quite clear let's say, riffing a bit on our great philosopher Yogi Berra's line, "It ain't over till it's over." This is true. It ain't over till it's over, but it ain't over then either, according to the dead saints.
Fascinating. Were you left with the impression that the soul is immortal? That we just continue going on, and then we choose to incarnate, or we go beyond that and into other levels? I mean, was that the impression that you got?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. This is implementing, I mean, bringing Gurdjieff, who's my own personal, the school I personally participate in, the soul has to be developed. In other words, we're not born with a soul, usually. Well, depends on reincarnation and so on. We're not born with a soul in the sense that an acorn is not an oak tree. A lot has to happen for the acorn to become an oak tree. And so with us, the soul has to be developed, and it gets developed through sometimes just life itself, but leading a good life and not being Dick Cheney or Rush Limbaugh. The soul can be developed haphazardly, but it can also be developed. This is the purpose of all of the religions, is the development of the soul. Development of the soul at a certain level, one which the masters attained, and I certainly, almost certainly will not. I just know something about it. We arrive at that state where, one of the things, put it this way, one of the things that every one of the near-death experiences, experiencers come back with is that they no longer fear death. And when you can say that you no longer fear death and be really assured of it, I can't say that I know that not to be afraid, but it doesn't mean that I'm not afraid. I don't know until the time comes when it's imminent. But for those who come back from the NDE, the one thing they come back with that is unshakable is that they know it's not actually the end, which to me is a pretty amazing thing.
Wow. That is. John, it's been a pleasure. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this upcoming tour that you're doing in Egypt? I know people just have a few days to sign on, but you'll be doing, I guess, another one next year.
Another one in February.
Go to your website. Yeah.
Another one, yeah. My website is jawest.net or .com, and the information on the trips are there. If anybody is in some position where they can just jump on a plane and join us, there still is room on the trip. I leave the 20th for Egypt, but you can leave the 21st and still be there on time. I like to get there a day early. Anybody seriously interested, email me and or call me, and I can get you signed on. I know that's not much time, but there will be one probably end of February. And for that, go to my website, and there's a place where you click to get on my mailing list. And if you're on my mailing list, then you get informed of the upcoming schedule. As I said, I don't have the dates finalized yet, but it'll be leaving probably somewhere around February 20th or so. And the prices and all of that sort of stuff are there.
Right. And do you pick specific areas to go to? Is it like do they change? Each one of them change as to what buildings?
No, it doesn't. I've been doing the trips for 35 years, refining so that it all works, like an old Swiss watch, which had moving parts, not a digital watch. And we go to most of the major places. We spend a lot more time. I mean, this is an exhausting trip, but if I can do it at 84, you can do it. And we go in depth into all of these wonderful places, and the itinerary is all there. In fact, it's pretty in considerable detail, and my own books, of course, are available, The Serpent in the Sky. The travel guide is out of print, but you can get it probably on Amazon. I have copies. I bought up the remaining stock. So the material's all there. There's a big, long reading list, and I hope to I see some of you either in a couple of days, if it falls out that way, or in... Are we on live, by the way?
Of course we are.
We're on live, okay.
Yeah.
And if not within the next couple of days, then in February, and if not in February, well, sometime or another, but I can't promise how long I'll be doing these trips for. Strangely enough, it's not a question of advanced age. I still get up and down the pyramid pretty well. But rather that who knows what's going to happen in Egypt in the future. At the moment, it looks fine, but you just don't know with if anything, in the Middle East. And the second is that I always have a handful of irons in the fire in terms of projects, video things, Egypt-related. And I didn't even mention this, that my other hat is my creative hat, and I always have film scripts and things like that that I'm hoping to find homes for. So one of those things come through, suddenly I'll find myself preoccupied for a couple of years and not be doing trips. But for the moment, I'm doing them. And you can, until otherwise advised, be sure that they'll be ongoing.
Great. Hey, always a pleasure, John.
My pleasure too, Cliff.
Yeah, real fun having you on the program. And I do hope that you and Dr. Schock can pull the trigger and come up with some more research and give us the next in-depth preview of really what these ancient structures were all about in Egypt. I mean, we get more information, but you know, it comes in trickles, and somebody will do a little research and they'll write a book, and it's a little bit more. It's fun, but most of them, like most people, like myself, are waiting for the big expose, you might say.
Well, this is what I was talking about. It's not even that it's the big expose. It's that something happens in one way or another, and the time for the idea, whose time has come, and then it changes in a hurry.
Right.
But that's, you can't predict that. For us personally, yeah, we would like to see. In my case, when I start working on this, it's almost just about 50 years that I've been working with Egypt, and Schock about, wow, since about 1990, with Schock it's about 25 years. That's a lot of work that we've done, and we would be very happy to see it come to fruition in the sense of becoming universally recognized. And it's not so much a personal thing. Well, part of it's a personal thing, that would be nice to make a living for a change, but recognized in the sense of its true spiritual importance, which in turn will or could reflect upon how people regard their own daily lives and their own significance or potential significance within the grand cosmic scheme. That's what distinguishes us from, you know, dogs and cats and worms and so on. Mm-hmm. As far as we know, they don't have that capacity to develop, and we do.
Wow. Well, continued success. Always fun having you on. And
thanks, Cliff.
Good fun.
In due course, I mean, you're probably on my mailing list. I'm not sure, but you should get on if you're not. And you will be, in which case you will be apprised of new developments when they, in fact, do occur. And if something major happens, well, we'll do another show.
Definitely. Okay, John. Hey, it's great having you on.
Thanks again, Cliff. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. That's John Anthony West, and always fun to have him on the program. Talk about a true elder statesman talking about Egypt. I just can't get enough. We can't get enough. And I didn't get a chance to ask him because our time is limited. And we'll maybe ask him next time. What are the secrets that the Hawass has? I mean, if they have free rein to dig into these structures, you know, what are they not telling us because of the advancement of knowledge? You know, I mean, it's too much. So that was fun. I want to remind everybody, next week our guest is Andrew Collins. Andrew just came out with a new book on Atlantis that is getting quite a bit of press, and he believes that the Caribbean area is the heart of Atlantis, and he touches upon something that has been close to my heart in the fact that the Maya as advanced as they are, it looks to be, and I've known this just based on the information from the natives that I've spoken to, the elders, that the true Maya were descendants of a very advanced race. And if you want to say they were the descendants of Atlanteans, that is your prerogative. I think a lot of people, when they use the word Atlantis, roll their eyes, especially in the academic world, simply because Atlantis is a joke to them. But when you look at the Maya and their extremely advanced knowledge of engineering, mathematics, sciences in, as a whole, it doesn't have a research and development period. It appears out of nowhere. And so this new book on Atlantis by Andrew is fascinating. And so that's our guest next week. And I hope you'll enjoy coming with us and being a part of that program. So that's it for today, and we'll see you next time.